Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
And I was up in Artane on a Saturday afternoon knocking on doors on his behalf, and some guy opens the door in a string vest, as you do, and he says, do you know what you need? And I say, what's that? Knowing nothing good was going to come. And he said, you need a bullet in the head.
Okay.
And I said, thank you very much and have a good day yourself, sir, and fecked off.
When you're knocking on doors, asking people for a vote, anything can happen. But when you're trying to get elected so that you can make changes that you deeply believe in, tensions on the doorsteps are a small price to pay. Lots of people think about running for election. Lots of people talk about running for election, but very few people actually do it. Having spent many years loosely involved in the world of politics, Cormac Lucy has now decided to go all the way. He's thrown his hat into the ring of the local elections in June. Coming up, Cormac is a Sunday Times columnist, lecturer in finance in Trinity College, and a very familiar face on television and radio. I wanted to know what makes somebody like him, after years on the fringes of politics, decide to suddenly enter the fray. And he had a lot to say about it.
The biggest weakness of the Irish public sector is that very poor performance isn't punished, and very strong performance isn't rewarded. And it's no surprise then that mediocrity is so often the result. Bourgeois, polite people find Ryanair disgusting. It's so uncouth, it's so cheap. Do you know what that man just said to me? Do you know what Michael O'Leary just said? But it works. It works because it is efficient and it is relentlessly focused on efficiency. Are we going to get efficiency from Pascal Donoghue? We're going to get a snooze fest at best.
There's just always...
It is right.
It is, that, and that's always, wrong, I see.
You know, well, I don't think it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I can see you grimacing.
I can't stop grimacing because... Yeah. But the poor, why do we just...
The poor today have living standards that are equivalent to the well-off 100 years ago.
Well, the 10,000 that are sleeping on the streets don't.
The hardest bit, actually, is bending down to shove leaflets through those horrible letterboxes that have little brushes on the inside to resist anything being pushed in. That's the downside of running for election.
Cormac and I come from, I suppose, different sides of the political spectrum stroke ideological divide. So you might enjoy listening to us thrash out some of the big issues in the country right now. All that coming up soon. But of course, because somebody like Cormac Lucy was coming on the show, we were inundated with voicemails directly to the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
Hi, you've reached the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Please leave a message.
Yes, hello Mario. This is Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform. Message for Cormac Lucy. Hello Cormac. I hear you're throwing your hat into the ring in the political arena, and I wish you the very best of luck with your campaign in the local elections. However, a little birdie told me that you're going to get proper stuck into me in this conversation. Now, I want you to know a couple of things. You want to watch your bleeding back on the campaign trail, Lucy, okay? You never know what might happen out in the Phibsborough region. Don't come on my fucking turf.
Hello, Cormac. This is Michael O'Leary here, Chief Executive of Ryanair. Nice to hear how gushing you're going to be about me and my little airline in this chat with Mario. I got a little heads up. I like the cut of your jib, I have to say. And I'm going to get behind you 100% in that little campaign of yours. I'm officially donating 3,000 vodka baggies and 1,500 steaming microwave nuclear paninis to each member of your team to keep them energised on the campaign trail and able to handle those gobshites on the doorsteps, the great unwashed. When you meet one, just remember to ask yourself, what would Michael O'Leary say? He'd say, shut up, that's what.
Hi Cormac, this is George Lee here from RTE. As you might remember, I also ran for election and spent a little time in politics before running back to the safety of my job in RTE as fast as I could. I just want to let you know that it's a nasty world full of strange egomaniacs with a level of scrutiny and pressure that you wouldn't believe. To be honest, I'm totally scarred from it all. But anyway, enough about RTE. I wish you all the best with your campaign. You might even hire me as your advisor if you get in and save me from this awful, 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 depressing, Stalinist, concrete jungle of a place. Bye.
So we invited Cormac Lucy onto the podcast to really try to understand what makes someone decide to run for election and what that decision-making process involves. So really, there was only one place to start.
Cormac Lucy, why are you running for election?
I'm running because I'm very unhappy at the way things are going. I'm 63 years of age. I've been operating the fringes of politics for all my life. I've always been very interested in history and politics, but it's not a great career choice. So I've always stood back when it comes to running. But what I see right now in the way our politics is going is just so concerning to me that I've decided I'm going to run. So I'm running for the council in Dunleary in the Blackrock ward. And what is it that is bugging me about the way things are? It's really about the managerial incompetence on housing, on health, on immigration, on crime, and the persistent placebo solution from our politicians, to say, oh, well, look, we're going to recognise Palestine. Oh, look, we're going to give you a referendum on this, that or the other. So they're retreating into symbolism rather than facing up to the bread and butter problems that are facing people. And that's what really pisses me off. And I used to be a member of Fine Gael for many, many years. So it's Fine Gael, which in my view is sinning most grievously in this matter.
OK, so you are adding, so you used to be a member of Fine Gael and you're getting into politics, the very party in which everybody's getting out of politics.
Yeah.
I mean, they are jumping out of this ship big time. One third of their TDs, it looks like now, will not run in the next general election.
Yeah.
Leo's gone. You know, so many are not running.
And it's going to be more. So there are a number who have clearly signalled they're not going to run, like Leo. I would question whether Pascal Donohoe will run. Michael Ring was offered a junior ministry if he committed to running again and he turned it down. So that number is only going to get greater.
And why now are you running rather than 20 years ago when you were 43? Or 10 years ago when
you were
53?
Because I'm... Back then...
Had you considered it before?
I had considered it before, but the situation today has got much worse. You know, if we just look, say, at yesterday's events in Brussels, where you had a political convention stopped by police in Brussels because they disapproved of what was going to be said there. If we look at, like, I lived 7 years in Germany. I'm very, very interested in German history. And the history of the modern Federal Republic of Germany is an anti-history of Nazism. They are consciously trying to be the very opposite of what the Nazis were. But yet, Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister, he was refused entry to Greece, to Germany in the last week because the German government didn't like what he was going to say about Gaza. So what we have is we've got a massive erosion in political standards because we have a generation in power now who think that the ends justify the means. And they're not concerned with rules and regulations and with constitutional rights. They want to win the argument. And we had this recently with our own two referendums, where the legal advice that the government had received clearly backed some of the central arguments that were being advanced by the no side. Yet this was flatly denied by ministers when they were interviewed on television.
That was a failure of politics, all right. And
it was black dishonesty. And it wasn't just a failure of politics. It was a complete failure of moral standards, where rather than saying, well, I can't disclose the Attorney General's advice because it's confidential or that's not my understanding, they said that black was white. And that is a new... That's a new step for me. What happened in Brussels? What's happened in Berlin? I know she wouldn't be my cup of tea, but Liz Truss has been touting her memoirs this week, and she's one of her central complaints is that she got into elected office in Britain, but she found that the middle management of British government was set against her and set out to undermine her, and eventually drove her out of office. Now, that obviously is a self-serving account of what happened, but it is not without a significant element of truth.
She was essentially saying it was the deep state.
Yeah.
Which would be a Steve Bannon and a Trumpian argument as well.
Yeah. Now, let's deal with Trump. How the hell can he be found guilty of a rape when the victim can't name the date when the rape occurred? And this happened, and the American...
Well, I don't think he was found guilty of rape. He was found liable for sexual assault, which is slightly different.
It's slightly different, but the state of New York lifted the statute of limitations to allow that suit to take place. So this is just one brick in quite a large wall, and that wall continues to be laid, and that worries me. Now, these are recent events.
Okay.
They're not the central reason I'm running. The central reason I'm running is that Irish government is ineffective, and it is ineffective because we have a bunch of young politicians who think that sound bites and clever media initiatives trump substantive delivery. And I want substantive delivery.
All right, so style over substance, you think, is there at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, take this back to you personally, all right? You're a columnist with the Irish Times. Sunday Times. You're a lecturer in finance in Trinity College. How long have you been doing that?
Got to 20 years.
Yeah, it's a good job.
Yeah.
And did you come from the finance background before?
I'm a chartered accountant.
Chartered accountant. Was that like KPMG or Price Waterhouse?
The forerunner of Price Waterhouse, Craig Gardner, as it
Craig
was.
Gardner, yeah.
Where Michael Collins worked
in
the day. Yeah.
Okay, that Michael Collins was...
And interestingly, like when you think about long political changes, when I was a trainee there in 1986, it was the first time ever that a Catholic senior partner was elected. So that firm had gone, trundled along as a Protestant-dominated firm for 60 years of Irish independence until they elected their first Catholic senior partner.
Okay, just back to you personally. So when did you decide... in your own mind, before you announced it publicly, when did you decide I'm going to run for political office?
It's hard to answer that cleanly. It's more a process than it happened on Tuesday at 11:30. I worked as a special advisor for Michael McDougall when he was Justice Minister,
who was also on this podcast.
Yeah. So I've gone to the edge of the water. In fact, I've walked into the water on occasion, the political waters. Now I'm running as a candidate. So working for Michael McDougall, that was absolutely fascinating. And he was somebody I could support with absolute enthusiasm. And he was also somebody who would be very much focused on rules and systems. And we have laws. We have to obey the law. I mightn't like this law. It has to be applied. It is the law. I get the feeling we have a modern generation of politicians where that simply doesn't apply and anything could happen. And that worries me.
Okay. Who was the first person you told you were running for office?
My girlfriend and my sisters.
Well, your sister was the one that
said... I've three sisters.
And your sister was the one that said, are you mad?
Yeah.
Because that was you wrote that in the article.
Yeah.
So what else did she say?
Well, just she was essentially... I suppose there are two ways you can view a decision to enter politics. You can view it from a distant third-party observer perspective and say, when we from the regular perspective that we adopt in modern life, which is a kind of a cost-benefit analysis and what's in it for me, Jack. And if you view it in a what's in it for me, Jack, it's a pretty dumb equation to opt for. On the other hand, if you are a political obsessive, if you want to change things, that is the system we have to do that, even if it is a highly imperfect system and even if the prospects, you know, the chances of an individual TD or an individual councillor exerting significant influence are quite low. Mm. But it's the best we've got. And if I'm, rather than just simply howl into the wind complaining in my weekly column about this, that and the other, if I want to actually go beyond that and try and change things, this is the next step.
That's commendable. Are you nervous?
No. I'm like, it's more a case of if I lose, I lose. If I win, I win. At least I'm now on the pitch of play and let's go for it. So I'm more nervous about failing to do my job properly than about how voters might react. How they react is entirely up to them. My job is to run the very best campaign I can and to be the very best I can be persuading them to vote number one, Cormac Lucy, in the Blackrock local electoral area.
Do you have a thick skin?
Yeah.
How do you know?
Well, I'm not so much have a thick skin. I can generally see everybody else's point of view, and even if somebody is going mad and screaming out the window, There's no point taking things personal. If somebody is screaming at you, well, actually, I was just at a lunch there, and Richard Bruton was one of the other guests, and I canvassed for him in one of the elections in the early 1980s, and I was up in Artain on a Saturday afternoon knocking on doors on his behalf, and some guy opens the door in a string vest, as you do, and he says, "Do you know what you need?" And I say, "What's that?" Knowing nothing good was going to come. And he said, "You need a bullet in the head."
Okay.
And I said, "Thank you very much and have a good day yourself, sir," and fecked off. If you're Ross Byrne playing rugby...
You didn't ask him if he possibly needed his taxes done or anything, did
not,
you?
Not that day. No. You know, if you're a footballer, somebody's going to slide tackle you badly, or if you're a rugby player, you're going to get smashed occasionally. That it just comes with the territory. So there's no point being overly sensitive about it.
Okay, yeah. I see a relation to that in a sense. If you, there's a chartered accountancy kind of, you need a certain mind to be a chartered accountant. I know several chartered accountants, and there is a certain theme that runs through them. And there's a logic. There is a cold logic to what they do. And that cold logic can spill over into actually being able to understand somebody roaring and shouting at them, because they actually see it from an intellectual point of view rather than an emotional point of view, and they can actually be quite tolerant of it. So the nuts and bolts of this, what is it going to mean, you running for election? Is it going to, you're going to have to work hard, are you?
Well, you have to get elected.
Before you get elected. The campaign.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to get elected. And to get elected, so you need, I think that the key thing that you need, this is my opinion, and when the election takes place, it may well turn out that my opinion isn't worth diddly squat.
Yeah.
I may well go down in flames.
Again, commendable for putting your name forward.
Yeah. So in my opinion, what you need before anything else is a clear message. You need a coherent logic as to why it
is
you're running.
Let's do it then. Cormac Glucy, your face is on the poster. What will it say?
It will say "New Independent Voice," because I've brought my leaflet in with me.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm really saying there is I'm not beholden to the existing party apparatus, and I'm interested in holding county council management to account and delivering more value for money for taxpayers and for citizens. So it's really about accountability.
Mm.
It's about getting value for money.
But are you going to be knocking on doors?
Absolutely, I will be.
How often?
Oh, I'll be doing this pretty much full time between now and June 7th, voting day.
Right. To the detriment of your work, perhaps? Will you have to put some, you know...
Yeah, well, I'll manage my work around it, but... Yeah.
It's going to be gruelling?
Yeah, it will be, but that's fine.
Mm. Are you a good walker?
Yes, I certainly am. Mm-hmm. I'd be doing my 10,000 steps a day, easy. So this is just this slots in quite nicely into my regular walking pattern, but it's going to be a lot longer. The hardest bit actually is bending down to shove leaflets through those horrible letterboxes that have little brushes on the inside to resist anything being pushed in. That's the downside of running for election.
Right.
Not meeting voters, not walking.
Yeah.
I think the foundation is having a coherent, compelling message. I think that's the foundation. Mm-hmm. And if you have a weak message, it doesn't matter if you're knocking on every door. You will get more votes if you knock on every door. But if you have a poor message, that's not going to be nearly enough to overcome it.
Can you change things from within a county council?
With difficulty, I would say. I think you can agitate for change. You can highlight where change needs to take place. You can, in your own way, boost accountability by highlighting where things are not being done properly. But I think an awful lot of the problems in local government are known and yet persist. And that is the most... The biggest weakness of the Irish public sector is that very poor performance isn't punished and very strong performance isn't rewarded. And it's no surprise then that mediocrity is so often the result. If you were in Ryanair and you put in exceptionally poor performance, you'd lose your job. If you put in exceptionally strong performance, you'd probably be promoted. And that's how an effective organisation works. It doesn't focus on issuing guidelines to its workers or endless notes on how to do things. It rewards good behaviour and punishes bad behaviour. It's very simple, but this is something that the blob or the embedded Irish public service would prefer not to have to face, because it's easier just not to face this. It's not comfortable laying people off. It's not comfortable choosing between staff and saying the following three put in exceptional performance and they're going to get a much bigger bonus than the rest of you. I know that I'm heading into a world of pain. That the political world is not a world of instant gratification. It's the very opposite. But I'm so perplexed and undermined by the way politics is going, and I don't see other people that I would like to see rushing in to fight these trends. So I'm doing it myself.
Yeah, once more onto the breach.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about where you stand. I mean, one word I wrote down there just from what you've said to me already is the word efficiencies. Now, when somebody says efficiencies, I always think that it's connotative of fairly right-wing economics. But having read a little bit about you as well, I think it's fair to tell my listeners that I suppose if I was to, well, you can do it yourself, but I suppose you would come down more on the right wing of the political spectrum, or at least centre-right. So ideologically, what kind of things do you believe in, Cormac?
Our society. I believe in things that work. That's what I believe in. And people have no understanding of the extent to which the Irish state in 2024 is being propped up by tax revenues, direct and indirect, from American multinationals. And then we look aghast at somebody promoting efficiency. So in 1991, I went out to East Germany to do missionary work. Well, not quite. I went out as financial controller of an industrial bakery that had been bought from the German government out of state ownership by an American multinational. So I was promulgating Western ways of doing things. Now, that meant we lost 2/3 of the staff. There was no drop in output. There was an increase in output because we invested a whole load of money to build new lines. So this notion that endlessly cosseting inefficiency is a virtuous goal to aim at, I think it is a virtuous political goal in the short run, because it avoids immediate discomfort.
But it means cost cutting, doesn't it? Efficiencies mean cost cutting.
It's a
euphemistic word for cut.
That can be an aspect of it. Yes. Yeah. But I
haven't got quite to where I want to go with this yet with you, and I know we'll get there. And it's for you to tell me what kind of way you like to see our society organized beyond just saying efficiencies. That's kind of an amorphous, ethereal, word. Okay, here's where I stand from. I'll try and you get into my head, right? So when I hear right-wing economics, or let's say neo-conservative economics, I think of, let's say, the world, but Britain, let's say, post-2011. And I hear George Osborne, and I hear Lord Cameron, or David Cameron as he was, and I hear Europe, I hear cuts, I hear austerity, I hear we need to take this medicine. A bomb is going to go off in Dublin, Minister, if you don't do this. A bomb? That's right. Remember what he said? A bomb is going to go off if you don't do what we say over in Europe. Cut, 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 cut. Austerity, austerity, austerity. Britain is destroyed, not only by austerity, but by Brexit, which exacerbated the austerity. Ireland was destroyed by austerity for years and years and years. Destroyed. This is what pretty much has led to the malaise that we're in now, the housing crisis that we have now, which was kind of one of the leftovers from 09 to like onwards. So this I'm trying to rile you, basically. I'm trying to provoke you. So this is the kind of economics that you would promulgate. So explain yourself. even though I've blamed you for something that you're going to probably deny now.
Listen, if there's somebody organising his or her garage or his or her kitchen and they do that efficiently, people would praise them for that. So the notion that efficiency is a negative value is just, it's counterintuitive. The notion that Britain has collapsed in the last 5 or 10 years, I just don't buy that either. I think it's underperforming, but it hasn't collapsed. If we look, you mentioned housing. So if you look at the government is pushing through a new planning act through the Oireachtas. It's 712 pages long. So we already have a severely dysfunctional housing market, and we have completely inadequate levels of housing completions each year. And how on earth is a 712-page piece of legislation going to assist that? How is that not going to add to complexity, add to the likelihood of legal actions, add to delays? So, you know, if we just take housing, I think that could be made significantly more efficient with a 5 or 10 year suspension of existing rules and regulations. And, you know...
Easier said than done?
Well, you can get rid of things. The question is, if you get rid of them, is what results then better or worse? So I would give the local planners in county councils significant autonomy to grant planning permission, and I would have a 1 or 2 page set of guidelines. You know, the Ten Commandments takes up a page. Mm-hmm. Why on earth do we need a 712-page piece of legislation?
Okay, understood. I mean, that's again, you're talking efficiency.
But sorry, it's understood. Where is the criticism of this coming from? From our supposed expert journalists, from Oireachtas debate. We don't hear this. Mm. Instead, there's this naive assumption there that there are people in the Department of the Environment and they must know what they're doing. Mm. They do on their ass. And the results are there for us all to see. Now, there's another issue with housing, which is woefully neglected by the media. In the last 25 years, the Irish population has grown by way more than any other country in the EU with a population of more than 1 million. It's grown by 40% in the last 25 years. So the key reason we have a housing crisis is that our economy is growing so strongly. Where is our economy growing strongly? It's growing in the multinational sector. It's growing in the sector which is the most efficient, which is the most tightly controlled for efficiencies. So that is where growth is. That is where the development prospects are. It's in the area that is well managed. It's not in areas that we manage poorly ourselves. And I find it sad as an Irish nationalist that, you know, I find it great that we've got the American multinationals to come in. I find it fantastic that the Economist magazine could feature Ireland on its cover page in 1985 with the picture of a beggar on a rain-swept O'Connell Bridge with the title Ireland, Poorest of the Rich. Mm. And then within 10 years, we were on the front page again and it had the continent of Europe in darkness, but in the West, Ireland, Europe's bright shining light.
True, but...
I find that fantastic. But I find it shameful that in our own domestic arrangements, we as Irish people living in Ireland, we have been nowhere near able to emulate the success of those multinationals, with one exception: Ryanair. You know, I'm 63. So when I was 13 or 14, a schoolmate of my father's from the Bish in Galway, Michael Killeen, was head of the Industrial Development Authority. So I've been kind of following IDA policy, Irish state policy, trying to develop enterprise for 50 years. And we do not have a single national champion that strikes fear into its rivals, apart from Ryanair. And bourgeois, polite people find Ryanair disgusting. It's so uncouth. It's so cheap. Do you know what that man just said to me? Do you know what Michael O'Leary just said? But it works. And it is efficient. It works because it is efficient and it is relentlessly focused on efficiency. But where is... Are we going to get efficiency from Pascal Donoghue? We're going to get a snooze fest at best. You know, there's nobody in government who is thinking or talking about these things or agitated about these things. They're better at reflecting to the public what their civil servants want than it reflecting to their civil servants what the public wants.
Fair enough.
And that upsets me and angers me to the point where I'm running for election.
Okay, very good. Now, a lot of people, when I'm in a taxi, right, I don't drive, so when I'm in a taxi, you know, you'll often hear the old, you know, rejoinder, you know what, Michael O'Leary should be running this country. I put Michael O'Leary in charge of the health service, right? Now, of course, you, as an economist, you don't need me to tell you how disastrous that would be if Michael O'Leary was in charge of the health service, I think. Or if Michael O'Leary was in charge of Corus Umper Éireann, as it used to be, or whatever, Irish Rail, I think. Am I not correct? I mean, if Michael O'Leary finds that, well, are we going to run buses down to Kilvantobeen? No, we're not. There's only 8 people there. It's not profitable. So shut up, they can walk. That's pretty much the way it works in economics, isn't it, Cormac? So Michael just wouldn't serve these areas because they're not profitable. So basically, hump off if you're not part, if you're, you know, not in the area that we like you. What do you think of that?
Well, just so you know, Michael's own people come from Kanturk, so he'd be familiar with rural Ireland and its needs. We need to make a distinction between the state providing services that wouldn't exist on a free market basis. And that's absolutely fine. I've no problem with that. That is necessary. There's that question. But then there's the second question, which does agitate me, the efficiency with which that's done. And there is no focus that I can see in our government on getting value for money. There is no focus on running things efficiently. There is no desire. There's no expertise among our top civil servants or among our ministers at managing things, at having had to meet a payroll bill on a Friday afternoon and worrying whether you'll have enough cash in the company till to pay it and scrambling to do that, or having to cut costs in a really severe way.
So overall, you're just saying there's a lack of expertise, there's a lack of competence, and there's a lack of a culture that strives for expertise, excellence and competence.
That's one big criticism. But the other big criticism is there is a substitution of spin over substance among our politicians. And there is a disregard for fundamental rights, as recent events in Berlin and Brussels suggests. Mm.
From where you are, why are there 10,000 people homeless?
I'd say it is a combination of a number of things. Number one, our population growth has dramatically exceeded our capacity to build houses. So our population has grown enormously, 40% over 25 years. That is huge. It's much bigger than what the States has experienced, much bigger than any country in the EU with a population of over the million. So population growth, number one. Number two, constipated construction activity. So
I'm talking about homeless on the streets. I'm not talking about people who have.
But if we have homes,
if
we have spare houses, then we can. You know,
but we do have spare houses. We have houses all over the place. Surely the ghost estates that were built.
Well, they were in what was euphemistically called the Upper Shannon Basin. I think that was a rebranding.
But don't we have abandoned houses? Don't we have abandoned apartments? Don't we have space all over the country? In other words, why do we have homeless people lying and living on the streets and sleeping on the streets, Cormac? From your political perspective.
I think a major reason is that the housing market isn't operating properly. So there was a recent report that found that 67% of people are living in houses that are bigger than they need.
Yes, that's right. But really, that's not really what I'm asking. Why do we live in a society where a government will allow thousands and thousands of people to sleep on the streets? That's what I'm asking you. So you've got I'm not necessarily asking for the solution or the answer.
Why is this happening?
Because this reveals your political.
Yeah, well, I think it's happening because the state has taken upon itself a mandate to house everybody, and the people who are homeless are turning up looking for housing. On the bus on the way in here, I passed the International Protection Agency, and they were letting people in one at a time. There were tents in front of the building there. So why are they homeless? I think it's mainly because we're not building enough accommodation. If there was more accommodation, we could house these people. I think there's a lot of drug addiction problems. That this is not applying to everybody, but I think addiction problems are a driver of this. And we don't have a functioning rental market. So we've driven, you know, the bed sits were banned by the government. So bed sits would actually have been, could well have been a tailored solution for a lot of homeless people who are just on their own. They want one bed, they want a sink, they want a toilet, they want a stove they can cook on and a TV, and that'll do them for the time being. You know, it's not an ideal solution, but it is an interim solution.
What about we face, maybe, I'll come at it from a different perspective. What about we face the disgusting reality? And the disgusting reality for a person like myself who has grown up being, I suppose, being a little bit of a left of centre, liberal thinking, younger man, then growing up to being slightly more conservative. And then as I got older again, I've gone back again towards slightly left again. So I've taken maybe not the usual path that people have gone, which is as you get older, you become more and more conservative. I've kind of lurched slightly back to the left. And the disgusting reality I'm talking about is, and from my observation of life and the world, is that the inevitable finish, end, outcome of the kind of economy we run is that there'll always be the poor, and the weak are going to get edged out. And tough, that's basically it. Because that's the algorithm, that's the equation, basically, that this economics renders. Isn't that right, Cormac? There's just always...
It is right.
It is, and that's always wrong, I see.
You know, well, I don't think it's wrong. Okay. I don't think it's wrong. The poor today, I can see you grimacing.
I can't stop grimacing because
the poor today have living standards that are equivalent to the well-off 100 years ago.
The 10,000 that are sleeping on the streets don't.
They don't. But there may be other problems. The poor today are way, way better off than they were 100 years ago. If we go for the left-wing solution, if we go for what the East Germans did, the problem is capable people want to flee that system. So if you push the equality dial too far, you discourage activity, you discourage innovation, and you risk driving your best people away.
But isn't the politics that you are seeking to enter a group of people who defend the interests of the people who are already in control of all the capital, all the power, and that really that is the name of the game, to control and to keep things in the status quo rather than to change system at all to benefit. Like, so for example, I've been saying ad infinitum on this podcast, what kind of country are we when a nurse and a doctor combined salary cannot buy a house together?
We're in a country that isn't building nearly enough houses.
Well, and
why are we not building nearly enough houses? Because we are grotesquely over-regulating housing. And we can have some fella in Dalkey objecting to planning permission being sought in Donegal and extracting money from people looking to build in Donegal. And what is the Department of Housing and the Environment doing about this? Very little is from what I can see. So I just think there are far too many people who accept the terms of the current system on housing and believe if we just tweak this here and there, we'll fix it. I think the system is fundamentally flawed. We need a dramatic simplification. And if it was me, I would declare a national state of emergency on housing and get on with building houses and get on with bringing in a €500 charge to object planning permission. You know, if it's really pressing, you'll pay the 500. If you're just being vexatious, that may put you off.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason why a doctor, like, I don't own a house. So I'm not preaching something to people that isn't affecting me. I'm not advocating a solution that I don't think is best for people who do not own houses. I think the best solution is a radical shake-up of our housing market and the rules and regulations that are currently governing it to accelerate house building. If you add to supply of housing, you will bring down the price. Now, there are lots of vested interests who will object to that. But I wrote an article for the Sunday Times last Sunday. So as a candidate in BlackRock, one of the things I do is I look at the electoral register. So I was looking through the electoral register for the names of people I know. And there was a 75-year-old former partner in PricewaterhouseCoopers And he's living in a house with five adults. There is a member of one of our higher courts. He's living in a house with five adults, all the same surname. So these, both of those are older than me. So the judge would be in his late 60s, the former partner in his early 70s. So I presume these adults, these other adults, are children or the spouses of children. So they must be in their 30s or 40s. So that the number of lives being put on hold because we have a completely dysfunctional housing market is shocking. And then we get the government saying last year we beat our housing target. Mm. Like, if I was a government minister in the current government, I would be saying, do not send out that message. It may be factually true, but it's only true because we set the target so low. Mm-hmm. And sending that message is going to really antagonise people who are struggling and who are seeing the prospect of home ownership disappearing further and further over the horizon.
Yeah.
But all of these stupid things are happening. And I think there's just a failure of political leadership at the centre to bring things together. And rather than allowing functional siloed interests predominate, as in the production of a 712-page piece of legislation, force a solution that will get answers. And that, and answers in this case means more residential properties being built fast.
OK. The Netherlands is about the size of Munster. And I think it's about 18 million people or something. Ireland has 6 million people, maybe 1 in Northern Ireland, 1.5 in Northern Ireland, maybe 7.
Yeah.
Altogether.
Yeah.
So Ireland has 6 million people and the Netherlands is 18 million people. But there's guys going around with flags all over the place going, Ireland is full. So this, of course, is the immigration issue I'm talking about. And what are your considered opinions on that, Cormac?
Well, Ireland is full if we're looking at availability of residences. Ireland is not full if we look at the availability of square kilometres. But our population has grown, as I said, by 40% in the last 25 years. That is huge. And this is the key factor underpinning the strains in the housing market. On immigration, if you look at the data over those 25 years, and believe you me, I have, the vast majority of the immigrants into Ireland over that time have either been returning Irish citizens or EU citizens or British citizens. So I don't see any problem there. The next two categories are people coming in on permits. So you have people coming in on work permits and you have people coming in on education permits. The work permits, I think there's a case for examining whether we should set a minimum income at which we will grant work permits. In other words, we're going to try and tone down the number of, you know, every person who comes in on a work permit needs to live somewhere, and that's one less place of residence available for somebody who's already here. Mm. The education permits, now I benefit financially from teaching foreign students, but I think there is a case for looking, examining carefully the net economic benefit to Ireland of having, bringing in students from China to do a master's degree here in Dublin or whatever. I suspect that is not advantageous given the crisis we have in housing right now, and that there may be a case for suspending or significantly running down granting of education permits for 5 years until we see some progress on this.
What about asylum seekers fleeing famine and war and desperate situations in their own country? Last week I had a very interesting lady on the podcast, a girl called Nadia Adan, and she's Ireland's first female car showroom owner. And she fled war-torn Somalia with her mother many, many years ago. And they were going around Europe as refugees until eventually they landed on O'Connell Street. And they were taken in and vetted and brought to the Justice Department and all this sort of stuff. And vetted and treated very kindly and with decency. I think the atmosphere has changed nowadays with regards to that atmosphere. What about asylum seekers fleeing famine and war?
We have to help people fleeing imminent death. So that's just, however great our own problems are, they're essentially problems of prosperity. And we cannot allow those problems smother our humanity. However, there are rules in the EU over how this should be done. So you're meant to apply for asylum in the first EU state that you land in. We've had repeated cases of people coming into Dublin Airport supposedly without travel documentation, even though to board their flight at the departing airport, they must have had travel documentation. So the implication is they've destroyed the travel documentation, their passports on the plane or just after arriving in Dublin Airport. So there is a limitless amount of human misery in the world. And we have to try to help people suffering and lift them out of that misery. But we do not have an infinity of resources. President Macron of France has said, of France, we cannot import all the misery of the world. So heartbreaking and heartrending as these stories are, we can't just... You know, I think that the refugee rules and regulations and international treaties did not foresee the sort of mass travel that we have in the modern age. And that then brings a brutal question. What, you know, how do we answer the trade-off between people who face unimaginable misery looking for a refuge here versus our own need for comfort and certainty and clarity as to what we're doing? Mm. So I think with most of these people applying for asylum, their needs are probably well grounded. The people who come in and tear up their passports, I wouldn't be very friendly to them. I don't think it was a very clever idea for Roderick O'Gorman to send tweets in multiple languages saying we're open to accept refugees. I think that was just crass and idiotic. Nor do I think it was Fine Gael in government's finest hour when it spent over €800,000 securing the interests of Ukrainian pets. I don't know what international treaty obligations we have to protect people's pets, but they spent close to €1 million on that. And so I think an awful lot of the problems that we face, we would face if we did not allow in any refugees at all. So I don't think that the refugees are the source of our problems. Our incapacity to build enough houses is the central source of our problems. Mm. And that needs to be the central focus of our political attention.
The a lot of European countries have a big presence of a far right element in their, either in their government or in their political kind of general complexion. Even Sweden, who I was lauding, I suppose, indirectly a few minutes ago.
It may have
been
a racist view you had of Swedes. Positive racist view.
A positive racism.
That they mightn't ever have far-right instincts.
But it's not that they have necessarily far-right instincts, but they certainly have a far-right presence in their political system right now in Italy and Hungary, and Poland, and France, and even Germany has a growing, again, far-right thing. But Ireland, not so much, even though it tries.
Well, they try.
They try. Are you worried about that, or do you think that's not going to happen here? And if so, why have we not seen significant growth in a far right?
I'm a massive fan of German history, and that's one of the reasons I went to live and work in Germany, and I speak fluent German. I have a book in my bag in German that I'm reading. I do not believe that the alternative for Deutschland is a fascist party. Now, you can, you know, what labels people choose to apply to other parties, that's for them to decide. It's a free country. But I don't believe that they are fascist. I don't believe, you know, I think one of the problems we have is we have a sort of a narcissistic age where people imagine that somehow I in my little life can do my thing to stop Hitler coming to power. Now, Hitler came to power in 1933, but I can stop the alternative for Deutschland winning votes, or I can stop their Swedish equivalents winning votes. And I think this is grotesquely exaggerating how right-wing a party like AfD is. And I also think it is boosting their support. That if I'm alienated from the system and I see the well-to-do bourgeois middle-class people saying, oh, the AFD is awful, it's terrible, it's disgusting, that inclines me more to support
them. The deplorables.
Yeah, that inclines me more to support them. So so the first thing I would say is I don't think that the term far right, when have we heard the term far left? Like the Social Democrats, with pretty articulate, utterly reasonable Holly Cairns at its front, is now saying equality of opportunity is not enough. We want equality of outcome. That is far left. That is East German in its aspiration. Where is the hue and the cry from the well and the good against that? There is none. So what I see here as a centre-right person is a bias in our political and media establishment against voices from the right, who, and they apply criticisms and censorship to that end that they would never contemplate applying to the equivalents on the left.
Have you been going door to door already?
A little bit, not a lot. I didn't get my leaflets delivered until yesterday, yeah. So I'm going out tomorrow.
Any interesting encounters you've had so far?
Not yet.
No string vests?
Not on this occasion.
Any bullets
cold.
In the head?
We'll wait for June and maybe that will emerge then.
Whatever you do, don't talk German to them anyway.
Well, maybe if they talk German to me, maybe I will.
That would be funny. So there's your man coming up the drive. What's his name? Carmack something. I'll open the door to him. Yeah. Good, V. Gates.
Yeah. Has gave me your good.
Haven't he?
Ich suche ihre Stimme.
That would be funny. Cormac, listen, it's commendable that you are running for election. I commend you for that. And I think it's very good that somebody should put their head above the parapet. And thank you for coming in and explaining your outlook, your perspective to me.
Thank you, Mario.
And that's it. My thanks to Cormac Lucy for coming on and getting his campaign underway and talking to the Mario Rosenstock podcast. My thanks to you for listening. Remember, you can get in touch with me directly, mariorosenstock@gmail.com. I read them all and I get back to most of them, as many of you already know. Absolutely interested to hear your thoughts, comments, constructive criticism, ideas for guests, sketches, etc. We're back at the same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.